The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is part two of my Hidden Bench extravaganza. If you missed part one with the owner, Harold Teal, check it out. And now I'm joined by the winemaker for Hidden Bench. It is Alex Baines. Alex, good, well, I guess right now, good afternoon. We've passed after 11 a.m. Price is Right has started. Bars can now serve alcohol. So good afternoon. Thank you for being part of the show today.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
You know what? Let's start in a very different place. What is life like for a winemaker now? As we're recording this, it's the end of January. It's foggy. There's snow. There's obviously no grapes. Everything is very quiet. What is life for a winemaker like at the end of January?
So I think in the winery right now, we're sort of looking ahead to our big spring bottling. So our first bottling run of the year will be the beginning of April, like I'm sure it is for many winemakers in the region. So for us, we have about 15 wines that we're going to be putting to bottle in April. So right now we're working on all those blends and putting those blends together, firstly in the lab and tasting all the trials, and then doing the work in the cellar and putting the blends together in tanks as well. We're also looking at barrels and running lots of lab work and tasting and checking and making sure everything's kind of moving and aging in the right direction. And then we'll be starting to get those wines ready for bottling.
What's the light period? When is Alex on vacation?
So I've been in the industry now for 14 years and I'm still waiting for that quiet period. So it's a bit of a myth, I think. There's always something to be done and
right.
It kind of shifts as the year goes on. I would say the summer would be the quietest time in the winery. There's still lots of blending and stuff to do. But then I spend a lot of my time on the road doing sales calls, events, that kind of thing. So it's a different kind of busy.
Right, right. But let's start with you for a second. Just looking at the very perfunctory research, graduated from Niagara College in 2015. And then 7 years later, promoted to winemaker here at Hidden Bench. First off, congrats, because I mean, this place makes killer wine, so you have a big part of that. I'm wondering if you could just talk, this is a big question, your pretty crazy rise from 2015 to 2020. Actually, we'll do it like this. From 2015, you joined Hidden Bench in 2017. What were those days like from the moment when you graduated from Niagara College?
Sure, yeah. And even if we could go, I'll go back a couple of years before that even, just because I give you a bit of background. So the wine industry was never something that I grew up thinking I was going to get into. I grew up about an hour north of London in the UK, close to Cambridge. And there are vineyards there now.
We're going to talk about Pinot. I want to talk about English Pinot with you, but sorry.
Yeah, continue. There are lots of wineries there now. There were a couple of vineyards when I was growing up there, but it wasn't something we ever talked about. Having a career in wine. It wasn't, 15, 20 years ago, it was never really talked about. And it's since I left England, actually, that the industry has really taken off. So it's kind of funny to see.
Then how'd you get into it?
So I actually went traveling when I was 18 to Australia. And I went for a month and I had a really great time. And I said, you know what, before I go to university, I'm going to take a gap year. And I'm going to go and live in Australia for a year and see what happens. So I ended up getting into the wine industry in Western Australia while I was living there. In order to get your second year working holiday visa at the time, they wanted you to do 3 months regional work. And I just happened to end up working at a winery. The first 2 months was actually on a bottling line. And I was like, wow, this is really cool, like super fascinating. It was a small family-run winery. So all the vineyards are on site as well. And I said to the guys, hey, like I need an extra couple months of work in order to get my second year visa. Could you keep me around? And they said, yeah, absolutely. We'll show you how to use a pump, drive a tractor. So I got to work in the vineyard, got to work in the winery, got to see all the different aspects in a short period of time.
Was that Margaret River area?
It was about an hour and a half inland from there at a place called Manjimup. Mm-hmm. So kind of close to Franklin River, where mm-hmm. Franklin Estates and Alcumia is about 40 minutes from there.
All right. We're going to keep going back then. You're in Australia. You probably could have found a job in a variety of different capacities, but you chose a winery. What was it about? Because you're 18, and you're certainly an exception. Normally, if you're 18, you're going to work at a bar. You're going to teach people English. Well, I guess not teach people English. It's Australia, but you might not go into a winery. What was it about a winery?
So, funnily enough, I actually met some friends in Perth that had done their regional work in the same town, and they went to a working hostel where once you got there, your name was put onto a list. Farmers would call and they would say, hey, I need 2-3 people for a month, 2 months, whatever it was. And so originally I went down there thinking I was going to get a job at an apple or an avocado farm.
Right.
And it just so happened that when my name was at the top of the list, a winery called to say, hey, we need some people to help on the bottling line. So it really was by happenstance that I came across it. And then the next year, so that would have been 2011. The next year in 2012, they gave me a call and they said, hey, like, we'd love to have you back for harvest. So I went back, and that time I spent 6 months there. And then my 2-year visa for Australia was up, and it was finishing up in September. And at that time, I wasn't even really aware that there was a different harvest times in the Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. And just from talking to friends, they'd said, like, with the Commonwealth connection, the next easiest place to go would either be New Zealand or Canada. And harvest happened to be in September in the Northern Hemisphere, right when I was looking to leave Australia. So I applied for a couple of jobs online for Canada. And funnily enough, when I first came here in 2012, I started at TARS. And one of the winemakers there at the time was Renee Van Eed, who is an Australian. And he had advertised on an Australian website, which was how I came across the job.
So this is a lot of just hand of fate stuff that led you to be sitting here right now. That's pretty cool.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just one of those things. It kind of just kept snowballing. And then when I got here, I did my third harvest, and I worked with Renee and Paul Pender, who was the winemaker at the time. That was it. I was sold. I thought, you know, this is something that I want to pursue a career in. So it was actually on Paul's recommendation that I applied to the college.
Right.
And he wrote me a letter of recommendation for the program. And that was really my time at TARS. I spent 3 years there, a year before I started college, and then the 2 years while I was in college. And that was really what shaped my sort of philosophy and vision of what I wanted to do in the wine industry.
All right, we're going to bounce around again. The two wines we're having, the cool thing is wow, is there a difference? Same vintage, 2021. The first one, I don't know if you would say it's your entry-level wine, and the second wine is Locust Lane Vineyard. So single vineyard, and the nose, just the aromatic differences on these two wines couldn't be more different. It's cool. I've been nosing it. I was wondering if you'd talk just a little bit about these two wines, I guess, starting with wine number one.
Absolutely, yeah. So the 2021 Estate Pinot Noir, you know, this is our sort of entry-level wine, if you like. I think the Estate series is a really great kind of holistic view of our entire property. This is a blend of fruit from all three vineyards. And I think it gives you a really good overview of the different sites. There's a lot of different sort of vine age, vine density, clonal material, all lots of different components to go into this wine to give it a really great complexity. And I think it provides really great value for money just with all those different components in one blend.
And by the way, the earthy notes on this one, dark, you know, sort of just more of a darkish red fruit. I say this all the time, so for people that listen on a regular basis, I apologize. The mark of a good winery is how much care and attention is in the entry level. Anyone can do low yield, hand-picked, best site, great oak, everything perfect to make a killer wine. But how is the first wine? And this just tastes exactly what you want from cool climate, a cool climate Pinot.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the 2021 vintage, it's very Niagara-esque. I think it's a really great classic Niagara vintage. They're delicate, they're light, they're finessed. And I really like the Pinots from 2021.
And then on the second one, the Singer Vineyard, the Locust. I mean, it's just the aromatics on this, the floral notes, the spice. If people want to know, oh, what's the difference between the entry level versus we're really going to focus and drill down on a single vineyard, you can tell just by spending a minute sniffing these two.
Yeah, so this one dials into a very specific part of our Locust Lane vineyard. We've got two different blocks of Pinot Noir that usually go into this wine. The Locust Lane vineyard, out of the three vineyards that we have, has the most clay in the soil. So these wines always provide us with the darkest fruit, the most structure, most robust. This is one that drinks really well in its youth, but definitely over time evolves and develops and can really reward some cellaring.
Oh yeah, like this, you could put this away for ages. How different was it 20 versus 21? 20 was considered a great year for winemaking, depending, you know, you'll get different opinions. Great for the Bordeaux blends, hotter year. 2021, certainly less heat. How different was it for you as a winemaker dealing with Pinot in two very different vintages?
So yeah, I mean, as you said, 2020 and 2021 could not be more different. The conditions were almost completely opposite. I think one of the interesting things about Niagara is that the vintage variation here means that you have to adapt and you have to be very dynamic in your approach every year. And as a winemaker, that's super interesting. I also like the fact that we produce a range of varieties, because every year is different, and each year certain varieties perform better than others, or, you know, are more suited to the conditions than others. So I think 2020 was a warm, fantastic year. The Bordeaux from 2020 are stunning. I do think it was almost too warm for some varieties, like, mm-hmm. you know, some of the aromatics struggled. I would even say, like, the 2020 Pinots and Chards, I think now they're sort of coming into their own, but in their younger time, they were big, robust, very dark fruit wines. Not something that I would necessarily associate with a classic Niagara Pinots and Chards.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of winemakers. A lot of them say they prefer the 21 Pinots versus the 20s, and maybe that'll change 10 years from now when it's had more time to age. All right, going back, what was life like for you when you graduated from Niagara College?
After I graduated Niagara College, I had been at Tars for 3 years, and I wanted to kind of experience something new. And so I actually moved over to Domaine Queluz for Harvest in 2015. And that was really great because I got to work with some other fantastic winemakers and mentors. Kelly Mason and Thomas Batchelder. And it was really great to see their approach and what they did. And then I wanted to go away and travel. So I actually spent the year 2016 abroad. And I didn't necessarily know if I was going to come back to Canada. I was in New Zealand in Central Otago for 6 months working at a small producer called Burn Cottage.
Oh, you're at Burn Cottage?
Yeah. So
they're so good.
The wines are fantastic.
Yeah.
So after my time at Tars, like I said, that time there with Paul and Renee really shaped my philosophy on winemaking and my approach. And I fell in love with Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, the idea of terroir-driven wines and a sense of place, and also organics as well. So when I traveled, I wanted to get more experience in those areas. So that was why Burn Cottage was a choice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just tried them last year and I was blown away with their Pinot. What would you say are, and obviously there's a ton, but some of the major differences between making wine inland of Margaret River versus Central Otago versus here in Niagara?
I mean, one thing I would say in Central Otago, especially, the disease pressure there is a lot less. It's dry there. They get less rain. They're kind of shadowed by the mountains a bit there. Their approach in the vineyard is very different. One of the things I think we struggle with here, especially as an organic producer, is the moisture and the humidity.
Right.
We get a lot of rain in Niagara. And if it's not raining in the summer, it can be upwards of 90 to 100% humidity. So, you know, with the humidity, you're getting moisture in the morning throughout the entire canopy. So I do think, like, one of the main challenges we have here is the humidity, but you have to approach things with a lot of attention to detail. And I think that's one of the advantages, at least here at Hidden Bench, where we are wine growers, if you like, and we're 100% estate, is we've been working with the same pieces of land now for almost 25 years. And, you know, the team has been here for a long time. Obviously, you know, Harold since the beginning, Joel, our vineyard manager, has been here for over 10 years now. And so these guys know the land intimately. And I think they know how to get the most out of each piece of land, which I think is really important.
That continuity must be so critical, especially during tough vintages.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the extra attention to detail and challenging vintages in the vineyard, but also in the winery as well, really helps us. We go through and we do a lot of sorting, especially in those challenging vintages, just to make sure that only the best fruit is getting into the tanks and into the barrels. So, you know, we can have, for the whites, we'll have 8 people on the sorting table sorting bunches. For the reds, it can be 12 or 14 people because we'll actually sort the bunches to stem the fruit, and then we hand sort the individual berries as well.
What was your family's reaction when you told them you're traveling around, and then you're like, you know what? Your friend or family reaction, like, that's it. Wine is that's the world I want to get into.
So I think after I'd been away probably 2 or 3 years, maybe when it was I first landed in Canada, I think they kind of knew that maybe I wasn't going to be coming back.
Right.
And I think they could see the excitement on my face when I was going to Canada, because that was really the turning point for me, where I had decided that this was maybe something I wanted to make into a career, as opposed to, you know, working intensely for 3 months in order to be able to travel for the next few months.
Right.
It was kind of like, okay, I want to switch and, you know, make this a serious thing. So I think they were happy for me, because it was not something that I necessarily would have found in the UK at that time. It's different now, I think. I think, you know, now it's very much with Plumpton and the program they have there and all the wineries and stuff in the UK now, it's something people growing up can be like, oh, I want a career in the wine industry. Like, I think my dad was telling me recently it's the fastest growing industry in the UK right now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You know, there's lots of vineyards being planted there, lots of new wineries popping up all the time. And I think with the international investment they've had from, you know, producers from Champagne and recently the US, it's really growing quite strongly.
All right, let's talk about England for a second, and then we'll get back to what were those early days like for you as a winemaker in March of 2022 when you were promoted. Your thoughts on English Pinot? I was introduced to it about 2 years ago, and someone asked, what did you think it was? I actually called it German. I'm like, this is Spätburgunder. I felt good about that guess. There's no way I was going to guess English Pinot Noir, but just thoughts on English Pinot?
Yeah, I've only had a couple, actually. One of the ones I remember pretty fondly was Gusborne, and I've had one from Balfour as well. They're very, very pretty, very light, very delicate. I mean, I think the labeled alcohols of the wines I had were maybe 11.5% or 12%. Mm-hmm. So I think they've got a good foundation there for sure. And it's interesting to me that, you know, it's only in their exceptionally warm years right now they're able to make table wine. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that changes over the next 10 or 20 years. But I do think like 20, 25 years down the line, that could be an interesting area for table Pinot Noir.
It's a funny thing about climate change. When I was in Germany, some of the producers like, yeah, you know, climate change, it's not the worst for us. Certainly not the ones making Pinot. I joke that the day that England can do 100% Cabernet Sauvignon and make it, you know, make a powerful Cabernet, I'm like, okay, the environment, we're in a lot of trouble. I mean, it must be similar here where you were talking about the investment. I could see a lot of people going, we've got priced out of Burgundy. Wait a minute, England, you know, it's almost like speculating about the future. And it's the same thing here in Ontario about the quality of the reds, the quality of the Pinot. And part of it is you still get more of that proper cool climate freshness required.
Absolutely. And I do think it's something, you know, we have to think about. And we've seen in the last 10 years, we've had more warm vintages, I think, than the previous 10 years. And, you know, for us, it's all about kind of every year we look at the season, we look at, you know, what can we learn? What can we take forward? What can we do differently? And I think it's really important to like continue to grow and continue to evaluate what you do. And like I said, one of the interesting things I find about Niagara making wine here is the vintage variation mm-hmm. and the challenges that come with that and the developments that come with that. So I think that, you know, it's something that we're just going to have to continue to be on top of. And I think for us as a region, because we've been doing that already, I think it's going to help us going forward because we're used to adapting every year.
What were the first couple of months like for you back March 2022 when you were promoted?
I mean, it was an exciting time. I mean, it's, you know, to be in a position where my first winemaking position is at a place like Hidden Bench was a great thing. I was very, very excited. It was a nice transition, I think, for me because I've been a part of the team for 5 years already. And the previous winemakers, Marlies and Jay as well, we worked very closely together. It was always a very collaborative effort. Same thing with Harold and Joel as well. Like, you know, we're a small team here, so we all work together. So I do think that support from the rest of the team made the transition a little bit easier for me. But it was extremely exciting. I mean, it was a dream come true, really. Like, I'd always wanted to work with a small producer that focused on organics and did terroir-driven Chard and Pinot. Somehow I was in a position where I was fortunate enough that my first winemaking job was exactly that.
And yeah, working at Taz and working with such incredible people and then coming here. If someone goes to a website, they go to this website, you see all the time, our wine is made in a non-interventionist style. I'm going to ask you just the dummy Captain Obvious question. What is it about non-interventionist that is so critical for making quality wine?
I think for me, the overall focus is we want to get as much of the vineyard character in the finished wine, in the glass, for people to taste. Everything we're doing in the winery, you know, we're very lucky to have such amazing fruit delivered to the winery every year from the vineyard team. And I think everything we do in the winery is to basically try to maintain the quality and maintain the character that comes in. Mm-hmm. And we're making very conscientious choices to be able to, one, display that in the best possible way and preserve that and not detract from that. So I think, you know, I always say to people that we work very hard in the winery to appear invisible.
Right.
So, because non-interventionist to me, like, I don't want people to think that, you know, at a winery like this, that we're standing back and not doing anything. You know, we are very busy in the background, like I said, tasting, working in the lab. Like, you know, I think Harold and I talk about this all the time, but, you know, winemaking is an artfully applied science. And, you know, we're lucky enough to have a full lab on site, which is a great help. But I do think, yeah, that we work very hard to appear invisible is the best way to put it.
How important is technology and science? You know, websites you can see where they want to hide the technology and the science. They want to make it romantic. It's just about Mother Nature, and you eat one grape and you realize it's time, and then you crush it into an old wooden crate, and then you put it in a bottle, and that's it. And there's no computers, there's no science. It's all just this beautiful romance. But that's not reality. That doesn't really exist at any good winery. I'm curious for you the role of that and the balance between science and art.
I think it's extremely important. You know, one of the big things for fermentations is temperature control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even simple things like having hot water as well. Like for us being an organic winery and, you know, all of our fermentations are done spontaneously with indigenous yeast that come in from the vineyard. So, you know, we want the winery to be extremely clean. So when those yeast and bacteria come into the winery, they're not competing with something else, you know, like in order to get the sort of the real origin of the vineyard in the finished glass, I think you need to be have an environment where those ambient and natural yeast can excel. And I think it's very important. I mean, again, at the end of the day, like, you know, I think we grow our wine. Like a lot of the hard work is done in the vineyard, and technology and science in the winery really helps us preserve that. And I think that it is very important.
We just try the Pinot. So what are the two Bordeaux? We'll put it on the mics in a second. But what are the two non-Pinot that we're going to be trying? One of them is a really interesting one, a 2021. Is that 100% Malbec?
Yeah, so we're going to try our 2021 Malbec. It's a really interesting wine for us. So we have about 4 acres of Malbec, 4.5 acres on the property out of the 10 planted in Ontario. So we do have quite a big share of the Malbec in the province. And in some years, we do make 100% Malbec. So it's a pretty exciting wine. We don't make it every year. But yeah, I'm excited for you to taste that one.
All right, let's put the mics down and give a pour. And we're back. Also, shout out to Harold, the owner. In the middle of our conversation before, he brought over 3 different cheeses and some crackers as well. Just fantastic. I find it is an interesting thing, the difference. I get this a lot, especially with Pinot. The difference between having a sip of Pinot and then having a sip of Pinot with, you know, a soft cheese, and just the difference. It shouldn't still amaze me, but it still does always amaze me just what it does to the palate.
Absolutely. I think it's when you get the right combination of food and wine, it can definitely elevate your experience.
We'll get to the fact, what the hell is it about duck that goes so damn well? Actually, what the hell is it about duck that goes so damn well with Pinot Noir?
That's a great question. I mean, I've always been a big fan of duck. I think it's the flavor profile sometimes in duck and Pinot tie in very well together. There's an earthy kind of savory element to both of them. And mm-hmm. I think they complement each other very well.
My first trip to France, to Bordeaux, I vowed to have duck at least once every day. It's a low bar to have. It's a low goal, but I managed to accomplish it, much to the amazement of my girlfriend, when she's like, "Are you going to order something else?" I'm like, "No, we're in the middle of Medoc, or we're in the middle of Cote de Bon. I'm going to be, damn it, I'm just going to eat a lot of duck with the Pinot." So the Malbec, I was wondering if you could just tell people, like, I'm still nosing it around. What should they expect if they try the Hidden Bench 100% Malbec?
So the 2021, I really love the perfume you get on the nose. It has a lot of kind of like lavender and spice characters to it, which I really, really enjoy. One of the things I find, it's much more kind of an old world in style, but it doesn't have that same kind of really intense structure that like a Cahors Malbec would have. It's much more approachable. So you have those kind of nice spice and savory characters to it. There's lots of nice kind of red and dark fruit characters to it as well. But the structure, it's firm, but it's enjoyable now, mm-hmm. which I really enjoy.
I went in with a little bit of nervousness. Part of it is I think maybe we just don't get the best Malbecs from Argentina at the LCBO. And Sperling and Peter Campbell, their Versado Malbec actually is one I really enjoy. Maybe I'm biased because of who they are.
Oh, I've had it too, and it's very, very good.
Yeah, okay, good. So I'm not the only one, but you're right. This doesn't have the overwhelming structure of either Cahors or sometimes just the red fruit punch on the nose of a lot of more mainstream Malbec that you get from
Argentina. Like a freshness and a kind of a delicacy to this for Malbec, which I think was you know, when we were making this wine, we had that in mind. That's kind of what we wanted to have in the glass. So
how hard would this wine be to sell? You were saying before, during certain points of the year when you're not, you know, you're not working directly, but the making of the wine or going through the vineyards, you're out on sales calls and things like that. I imagine that must be a hard sell, because you've got to get the people at the restaurant to tell the story of Hidden Bench, because people are just not used to Malbec from Niagara.
For sure. And, you know, we have a very loyal wine club following as well.
Right. And oh, this must get snapped up by the club.
Exactly. Yeah. So ordinarily, this would be basically solely bought by our wine club.
Right.
So we only make a small amount of this. But again, we work with a lot of really great restaurants as well. And, you know, the more and more that I get out and I talk to people, it's a very pleasant surprise for people when we taste it.
Yeah.
Not something they're expecting, but something they find very, very interesting. And I mean, I think there is a customer base for Malbec, you know, but a lot of people, like you say, they just don't associate Ontario with that variety. But it's everybody's pleasantly surprised by it, I think.
How much do you enjoy when you're going on a sales call and someone who hasn't tried your wines, and maybe the Somme or the owner who doesn't drink a lot of Ontario wine, and then they're trying it, and they're trying the Pinots or the Bordeaux blends, and you can tell that they are not only enjoying it, but they're surprised by what they're tasting.
It's hugely rewarding, and it's something that I've, you know, been doing more and more now, and all the events and everything I work, it's just great being able to get out in front of people and kind of explain to them what it is we do and how we do it. And I think, like, when you taste with these people, they can see the passion, you know, in your voice or on your face, and, you know, they love to feed off that, I think. So it's always really great introducing wines to new people and meeting new people. And
the Bordeaux blend, is this the wine that you would use to convince the 53-year-old man that maybe they don't need to just drink California to have a big red?
I think so, and especially from 2020 as well. Like I said, right. That vintage was an absolutely perfect vintage for those varieties. So, you know, we do pour this at the winery quite often for people that like, you know, kind of big California reds, and they are very, very pleasantly surprised. We always have Midority Merlot in our blends. So it's kind of like a bit of a right bank blend, if you like. And then again, there is a component of Malbec in this too. So I think that makes this kind of a unique red blend, even from Ontario, just because it doesn't have only kind of Merlot, Cab Franc, Cab Sauve. It's got a component of about 20 to 25% Malbec in it as well, which just gives it a really unique character.
Yeah, it does. And also, it's fun for you to play with Malbec. I mean, that's not something you normally get to do in Ontario. How would you define what good Ontario Merlot should be like?
It's a good question. I think one of the most important things for Merlot in Ontario is site selection.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's one of those varieties that, depending on where it is, it can either thrive or struggle. And I know, you know, we've got some really old vines of Merlot at our Rosamel property that go back to the early 80s, which is really quite special, because in my experience, if you can get 20 years out of a block of Merlot in Ontario, that's about, it will eventually succumb to winter damage. So to have something that's, you know, 40 years old now in that vineyard is very, very special. But Merlot for me, it's always the component of the blend that gives this nice kind of plummy character. It adds some delicacy, it adds some softness. It's what I think can make those blends approachable. And then the other components in there, I think, are a bit more for kind of, you know, darker fruit, structure, longevity. And that's kind of what I like about the fact that, you know, we focus on a red blend. Harold's always been a big believer in that kind of the art of assemblage. And it's great because certain varieties will excel in certain years for the Bordeaux. So you can always knit together something that's consistently very good.
How many people decide for the Bordeaux blend what the final numbers are going to be with the grapes?
So what we'll do with all of our blends actually as well, with the single vineyard Chards and Pinots and the Bordeaux, is we actually sit down as a team and we'll taste all the individual barrels. So, you know, myself, Harold, Joel, our retail manager, Matt as well, we all sit down, we taste every single barrel and we go through and we take notes and we kind of pick our favorites. And then what I'll do is I'll take everybody's notes and I'll go through and I'll put together some trial blends. And then we'll go back and we'll taste those blends together. Maybe there's a second iteration. So it's very much a team effort.
How much fighting is there? And I'm suddenly thinking of, you see a sports movie, you know, all the scouts are in the room debating who to take in the draft. And then some of the scouts love this guy, some love this guy, they fight. And then at the end of the day, they got to make a collaborative decision. Is there fights? Is there bickerings? I want to hear about the skirmishes when it comes to deciding the blends and what oak and all that kind of jazz?
I would say for the most part, it's pretty level. There are some heated discussions when people feel passionately about certain barrels. And I think it's more so, you know, people advocate for a certain barrel. If they really love it, they tell us why. And, you know, and that's great. I mean, that's what it's all about. And that's why, like, even though, you know, I have the title of winemaker, like, you know, we make the wines as a team. And I think it's really important to taste together and put forward the best expression of our wines that, you know, we came to a consensus as a team about.
What scares you more? Frost in late May or riding your motorcycle on a wet road on a wet day?
That's a good question. I'd probably say frost in May, to be honest. My motorcycle has a rain setting, so I have some sort of comfort there as well. And you know, I wear all the gear, so it's God forbid I ever go down, hopefully I'll be okay. But yeah, unfortunately, frost, there's not much protection from that. So
what would be, and again, you were mentioned before just about there's more, you know, just disease here and then say, I think you were saying in New Zealand. What is the single biggest thing that scares you? Is it something to do with humidity? Is it rain at the wrong time? Is it frost around May 2-4 weekend? If you could only pick one where nature is really just giving it to you guys, what would be the number one?
I mean, I think one of the most challenging things is always rain during harvest. I think, you know, you're right at the end of the line, the last hurdle, if you like.
Right.
The grapes are, like, you know, pretty well ready to go. And, you know, you have to be very strategic in your picking decisions. And I think, and again, because we're 100% estate and we're a small team, like Joel, Harold, myself, we'll all get together at harvest time and we'll make the picking decisions together. And I think one of the advantages of being a state and kind of not having to rely on any outside influences is we can be very dynamic in our plan. If we see that a certain block is at the optimal place to pick, we can say, hey, you know what, we're going to pick this and then we're going to go back over here. And we really can make the best picking decisions for the grapes. You know, if we've got 2-3 days of rain coming, we say, hey, you know what, we're going to push hard for 2-3 days. We're going to bring in this fruit while it's healthy. And I think, so those decisions, I think, are, you know, some of the most important. I mean, you know, your picking decision really does shape the trajectory of that wine. So, and it's amazing how much, if you push things an extra few days, how much the flavor and complexity in those grapes can change.
The rain at picking, that feels like in a horror movie. You're near the end of it. You've survived. And then suddenly Jason Voorhees pops out of Camp Crystal Lake and you're like, God. Damn it. I need to know more about this. I love on the website, you guys have everyone their aha wine. I have never heard of Pyramid Valley Earth Smoke Pinot Noir, which was one of your aha wines. Can you tell me about this wine?
Yeah, so I mean, Pyramid Valley was a winery that I kind of had heard about from traveling around, and they're just outside of Christchurch in New Zealand.
Yep.
Again, they're an organic biodynamic producer. They've got, you know, a few different estate vineyards, of which the Earth Smoke is one of them. I just remember trying that wine. I think it might have been in my early years in Canada. Someone brought it to a tasting. It was just such an incredible wine. There was so much life in that wine, and you know, you could really taste the care and attention they'd put into making it. And I think that's kind of what excited me about it most. And again, that was right around the time where I was sort of falling in love with organics and Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and this idea of terroir and a sense of place. And I think that wine summarized all of those things. And that's kind of why I was so excited about it. And so actually when I was in New Zealand in 2016 and finished up harvest, I did go and visit Pyramid Valley and got to, you know, visit the vineyards and the site there. And it's almost like an amphitheater. It's a really, really unique site where they've got this kind of curved hill that goes around a pond, and all of the vineyards are kind of on that slope. And yeah, it's a pretty special place.
It reminds me of just advice I always give. If you can no longer afford Pinot Noir, you know, from Chambertin, from, you know, wherever. Now, those ones in New Zealand, they're not cheap. Otago, not cheap. But between that and, like, you know, a lot of the wines you worked at K-Loose or here or Batchelder, that you can get some pretty killer, cool climate Pinot that maybe it's 5% not as good as you like your Burgundy, but it's 60% less money.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's some incredible value to be found in Niagara wines. And I think, you know, we're improving all the time. And we're starting to get out there more and more, and people are starting to know and hear about Niagara and know the value it can, you know, produce.
What was the first time you went on a sales call? Or you just went, not even a sales call, just went out peddling your wares, going to restaurants, getting Hidden Bench into the glasses of Psalms?
So, I mean, that was, you know, when I took over sort of 3 years ago now was when Harold and I, we started to go out together. And, you know, more and more now we go out together, we go out individually and just kind of spread the word and show people what we do. And
I'm wondering, is it any easier now? Is it still the same? Is there a restaurant that you're like, damn it, we got to get on that program?
I mean, I think, like, for me, like, the more and more time that I spend at these events and, you know, meeting people and networking and all that kind of stuff, like, you get to know more people in the industry. Mm-hmm. Like, always kind of being in the cellar and the production side, I was never, until I took on this role, I was never really in a position where I was going out and meeting that side. So, you know, it's been great kind of working with Harold, and he's introduced me to his contacts. And yeah, the more and more time I spend, the more and more people I get to meet. And that side of the industry is super important. Like,
yeah,
we view all of our licensees as our partners, because at the end of the day, like, we have to work together with them to get great wines to the table and to customers. And they're a big part of helping us do that.
Yeah, it's all about just telling the right stories. Are you better at it now? And I bring this up because I once briefly worked for a wine consignment company, and the wines I was selling, I was buying. And, you know, I can yammer. It's one of my few skills. I was horrible at it. I was horrible at sales. Like, I couldn't do it at all. I'm wondering, you know, for you, are you better at it now? I'm always curious about anyone who does anything on that side of the wine program.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was definitely nervous when I first started doing it. I mean, you know, you go from a role where there's basically no public speaking in the winery and the cellar, but obviously you're talking with your team, to then going out and kind of presenting for people and all that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, I spent a lot of time with Harold and also with Matt, our retail manager, kind of listening in on the tastings they host here. And you pick up those little kind of tidbits and stuff. But, you know, obviously I was very confident on the winemaking side, and it was just more so adding in, you know, the stories and stuff with that as well to give people an idea of place and what we do and the history and all those kind of things. So it's definitely something that I think, you know, I'll always be trying to improve and get better at that.
Sure. Yeah. More of a personal question, one that certainly has a much more tragic angle to it. How important was it for you, June of 2022? You were I believe, the first winner of the Paul Pender Memorial Rising Star Award at the Ontario Wine Awards. How important was that for you professionally and also personally?
I mean, yeah, incredibly important for both, on both a professional and a personal level. I mean, you know, Paul, like I said, he really was one of my first mentors in the wine industry, and he's really shaped my philosophy and approach to winemaking. So he's a hugely significant part of my journey. You know, he was the one that introduced me to the idea of terroir and a sense of place and organics and Pinot and Chard, and just his enthusiasm for Niagara and what Niagara can do, I think it really rubbed off on me while I was at TARS. And, you know, even now when I'm putting wines together, and, you know, I still think about kind of some of the advice and the tastings and the guidance that he gave me, you know, all those years ago. So, and to be, you know, nominated by my peers as the first recipient of that award was hugely special.
Yeah, I mean, congratulations on that. People don't know, and the reason the tragedy was just around 3 years ago, where he passed away at an incredibly young age. And that was one where everyone in the wine industry felt it, like the idea of Paul no longer being around, like that. You could just sense this, everyone collectively just sort of like punched in the gut and the soul when that news came out in February of 2022.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a huge loss to the industry and, you know, to his family and everybody who was close to him. But I think that he touched so many people in the industry that,
yeah,
you know, he'll live on in everybody's memories forever, because we all have such amazing, fantastic stories about Paul and about the wines he made. And yeah, so I think he's going to live on in the Niagara industry for many years to come.
What are you excited about next? Again, you're young. I mean, and you've accomplished so much and traveled around and now here at, you know, such an incredible winery at Hidden Bench. What is next for you, Alex?
So I think one of the most exciting things about Niagara, and I think I briefly mentioned earlier, when I went away in 2016, I didn't necessarily know that I was coming back. I went from New Zealand on to California, actually, to work a harvest at Flowers there as well.
Oh, at Flowers?
Yeah. So
really?
Again, organics, Chard and Pinot. I was working up at their estate site on the Camp Meeting Ridge Vineyard. So we did, you know, about 200 tons of their estate fruit there, which was really special. You know, after that vintage, I ended up coming back to Niagara. One of the things I loved about it here was just, I think there's an opportunity to kind of shape the future of this region here. And there's a lot of young winemakers now in this area that I think to be a part of that community is really, really special. So I think for the future for me, I really want to see this area continue to develop, you know, for us to really dial in on what we do well, but also to be able to get that message out into the world in a national and international level as well. I think like that's kind of the next leap forward for us, is to get the message out there and, you know, bring wine critics and wine enthusiasts from around the world to this area and kind of show them what we do. And I'm really excited to be a very small part of kind of pushing Niagara towards that.
Yeah, an important part. Like, you know, you guys, Kaluse, Westcott, Batchelder, I'm forgetting so many, you know, some of the other really good ones. As I look at you guys as sort of the tip of the spear of what high quality Niagara is all about. By the way, you've really bounced around a lot of really good Pinot and Chard producers. Like Flowers, you know, they do good stuff in California. And of course, we've discussed a lot about New Zealand and Taz and then Hidden Bench. You've really sort of just, your life path has taken you a lot of good Pinot and Chardonnay producers.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, I mean, you know, a lot of that I owe to Paul. Like he really mm-hmm. did kind of shape my philosophy and my passion. And, you know, he was passionate about a lot of the same things. And I think whenever I've traveled, I've tried to be very deliberate and kind of create a niche for my experience and what I wanted to do. And yeah, I've been fortunate enough and lucky enough to be able to do that. So
Alex, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. You know, there's no, as you said, there's no light time of the year as a winemaker. So I appreciate you taking time out of your day to be part of the podcast. And I would recommend to everyone, come by here at Hidden Bench. It's gorgeous. You got to book an appointment, but do book an appointment. Or, I mean, you can come in and sit at the patio, but, you know, come for a proper tasting. So, Alex, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for doing the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.